Welcome to Keep Making Movies, the podcast where we explore, shall we say, movies that may have needed a bigger budget. We evaluate the movie for what it is, decide if it could have been improved with a budget, and if it will join our Keep Making Movies official recommend list. I'm your host, KJ, and with me is...
Tom.
Today, we are discussing Aaron Hahn and Mario Moscone's Circle and their previous work, The Vault. The Vault is a web series released on YouTube and Circle's a feature-length film currently on Netflix. Hopefully, you've already seen it. In Circle, we are locked in a room with 50 people. One of them is killed every 2 minutes. Who dies? Well, that's up to the people in the room who vote somewhat anonymously, and the movie carries us through the decision process of the people until there is only one left standing. In The Vault, we follow contestants who have been winning a game show who finally get on the game show The Vault. There are at least 150 of them. I guess you could argue almost 300, depending on exactly what was going on there. But they're each locked in an individual room, and they have to work together to get through this game show, mostly through one guy who's got a headset that can talk to each room individually or in mass. And in that, we find that they can work together. And even though they almost get out, you almost have a portal scenario, spoilers for the game Portal, everybody, where you kind of have to peel back and you end up backstage behind the game show. So Tom, what do you think the goal of the creators were for either Circle or The Vault?
I think in the instance of Circle, the goal of the creator was to reveal the inherent nihilism of the human condition. We're all going to die, and we will, for an extra 2 minutes of life, claw everyone else to death in order to stay above the water, or, you know, what have you. Push someone else down into the murk in order to keep ourselves afloat, that type of thing.
Yeah, it was like a trolley problem. You know the trolley problem? Trolley problem is it's a fun little mind. Well, it's not that much fun, actually. A mind exercise where there is one person tied to the railroad tracks and a trolley's coming. If you throw the switch, you save everybody on the trolley, but it runs over the dude tied to the tracks. So you have to decide, are you going to pull the lever to, you know, kill the dude that's tied down? And then there's variations. There's more people tied to the track, or I think they call it the fat man problem, where the guy in the track you know is evil and bad. Does that influence your decision about whether to... So there's variations on the trolley problem. But that's what they're kind of doing in real time. They're trying to figure out, okay, who should be the next one to die? And like you say, they have 2 minutes. I'm assuming the director was trying to say, look, if life was only, 40 minutes, or however long it takes to kill everybody in the room, is these 2 minutes our decisions that we make every day to decide if we're helping our fellow man or not? I do think that was the goal of this movie, to comment on that.
I agree to an extent. I think it is also part of something which I really hate, but a way of looking at the world. When the barriers of social respectability are taken away, how do people act? And this is also often a theme in movies, right, or a theme in art or whatnot, is there's this veneer of respectability that allows us to kind of cohabitate, but somehow it's false or hiding our true nature. And our true nature is much more bestial. And now these people are put into an absurdist situation in which that social veneer is gone. It really cannot be there. And so they act how the director thinks human beings actually want to act, which is, you know, incredibly greedy.
Ruthless.
Ruthless.
Manipulative.
And for very little, too, right? They're manipulating and killing in order to get an extra 2 minutes of life.
Well, I also think most people in there thought they were going to walk out.
Yeah, or for the very, very small chance you will walk out. So people will, or most people will, willingly trade dignity for the tiniest chance that they will survive. Now, I think this does not in any way strike me as an actual document of human behavior. I mean, history is filled with great examples of people who are oppressed and then make incredible sacrifices for fellow people, right? We see almost none of that here. We get maybe a few people who are willing to step off of their red circle and die. Their deaths seem entirely meaningless. They buy an extra 2 minutes, which then turns into another conflict. But basically, everybody becomes a jerk, pretty much, with the exception of one or two or three people, as soon as this machine starts killing them. They also don't really explore how to stop the machine. They seem to have no interest in charging it. One of my thoughts was, well, they keep removing the body, which means a door is opening. Why doesn't anybody try to go out one of those doors when the body's being taken? Now, obviously, these are silly questions. The idea is that, like, they're stuck in this circumstance.
Right, right. I think the movie's answer to that would be if they step off the circle, they get zapped.
Yeah, exactly. But we don't really see them test that. But that's fine. The movie has kind of has that built into the design. But the things that people resort to are really kind of eye-rolly, right? It's we see people act bigoted, or we see people act ableist, or we see people act homophobic, those types of things that are, it almost seems like a checklist of normal human fallibilities that I often think conflict and life and death conflict sort of erode. You know, I often find these kind of bigotries to be very often a situation of comfort rather than of stress, and that people, when they have a common enemy or a common threat, kind of more come together as opposed to fray. So I find this to be entirely false. It's what I call hipster nihilism. It's this belief that deep down we are meaningless animals seeking merely to reproduce. I don't think the human condition reflects that at all. And I find movies like this to be, I know this is a low budget movie with aspiring directors, but I kind of find it irksome for that reason.
Well, I think you're answering the question, but how do you think they did with the money they had?
I think they did fine for the money they had.
I like the set. The set was pretty great. Like the visuals of the triangles, the circles, they were very clean. I like how the black background gave you this sense you didn't know how big the room was. I really like that. The lighting was good. The special effects were fine.
Mm-hmm. The yellow lights.
Well,
the
yeah,
yellow filters look a little bad.
Touched by an Angel hologram lights there. Yeah. But I still, even those, I'd say, especially, 2015 or, back then, I they looked fine. They did not take me out of the movie.
Yeah, they didn't take me out of the movie. I wonder why they didn't just put a yellow light on them. I mean, when
instead
that
of the
have done models. The same thing. Yeah. But you're right, it didn't take me out of the movie. And it's also the pleasure of it is the cheapness of it. You know we can't leave that room. So, and I think that there's a lot of value in that, in the sense of we can't leave that room, so we have to watch, 12 Angry Men fight it out, right? to think of another famous movie that is entirely situated in one room.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and that's a good comparison. So in 12 Angry Men, you have ups and downs. You're, as an audience member, you're kind of swayed, not that much, but you're swayed to, oh, maybe the guy is guilty. Oh, maybe he is innocent. Back and forth, there's tense moments, they take breaks. In this movie, you're not really sure what anybody can do to improve the situation. And since that's not telegraphed, it loses some of its tension because we don't know if anybody is succeeding because we don't know what they can do to succeed.
I think it's a good point. You don't know, can anybody actually walk out of here?
Right.
Right.
And if it's only one, then why is anybody really bothering to worry about it so much?
Why do we care so much if it's one random person who's kind of probably a schmuck, which turns out to be the case, right? It's one guy whose name we don't know. We don't know anything about him. And he's definitely a schmuck. And he's the one who walks out of there.
Right. Which, I like endings that hurt like that, right? I do like endings that don't feel good. I would have been totally fine if all of them were killed in the end as well.
Yeah, but it's also inconsequential.
Right.
Like that
right.
That guy won. That.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And him also leaving. So for anybody who hasn't seen the movie, we're spoiling it. But one guy whose name we don't learn.
I think it's Eric.
Oh, maybe it's okay. He seems kind of nondescript at the beginning, but in the end, he sort of tricks a pregnant woman and a child into dying.
That's not even the worst thing he does.
What's the worst thing he does?
Well, I think you have
killing
to watch the movie
pregnant
closely.
Baby.
Yeah, then you got any oh. Right? Which I mean, if the, I don't know, I don't want to get into the details of this.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, he then kills a, I guess it's not
unborn, a, yeah,
unborn baby. after killing a child, and then he's able to leave, and you see him in Los Angeles looking at spaceships with a bunch of other people, and there's voiceovers about what are the voiceovers covering in that last scene?
I can't remember either,
but I don't remember them mattering. Right, and so it's like, well, presumably these aliens went through this process to find the most Machiavellian person, and then...
Well, to be the top 2% of the population who's the most Machiavellian.
But they're just going to populate the world with Machiavellian Angelinos? Is that the pot?
It's kind of weird, right? If you follow this through, how many Erics survived? I don't know, because there was a lot of children and pregnant women. So are they going to wait a while until... I don't know. It's a weird... Like, the sequel would be weird. Circle 2 would be pretty weird.
Yeah. I mean, and so usually with an absurdist thing is you get to some sort of conclusion. You know, like in Waiting for Godot, they sort of realize, oh, life is about waiting. Life is just waiting for this grand thing that's supposed to happen that never happens, right? We have this sense of almost a dramatic sense of our own lives as... There's this amazing thing that's supposed to happen, and then, you know, and then that's it. And it's really what life is about is day-to-day, mostly boring stuff, you know, with a few highs and a few lows, but mostly it's boring. And that's the kind of grand conclusion. That's the climax of Waiting for Godot, is life is not based on climaxes. With this, I guess it's the vicious get ahead, but... What, like, the vicious get it, like, in the future is going to be just made up a bunch of Erics who I don't know yeah. What profound thing I'm supposed to get out of it, or, you know, I think the reason why we sit through this movie though is to see, hopefully get some explanation as to why the aliens did this thing, or if they're aliens, or what the aliens look like, or something like that. Which fortunately the director does not give us. I think that would be a bad choice on his part or their part.
So do you think a bigger budget would have helped this film?
Not really. I mean, it might have looked a little bit better, but the pleasure of the movie is the immobility of it, that we're stuck in that room.
Well, I was picturing, have you ever seen Lost, Tom? You know, the
I've seen a few episodes
all
of
right.
It.
That's probably enough to go on. I wonder if you focused on a few characters and then told their backstory as we went along.
Oh, I see.
So if you had a little more money, you could have gotten out of the room by, I don't know, the cop, and then you cut to him in a small snippet of his life that now you understand the cop better and you understand where he's coming from. Or, yeah, pick anybody in the room, the old people, whatever. And... could have told, you know, a similar story, but it could have had either more to it, or I don't know, been
have characters.
More impactful, have characters.
Yeah, that's that, what it could have had, characters.
Yeah.
That's and kind of the problem.
Yeah. Everybody's kind of a stereotype or a stand-in for a social problem that's going on right now.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. It's a stand-in for a social problem. So the, you know, the African-American character is a stand-in for racial insensitivity, as is the cop. The businessman is a kind of a stand-in for an insensitive corporate greed, I guess, as is the banking guy. But I think, yeah, if you actually had
The banking guy was awesome. He should have been the whole thing. His mouth, it's like disconnected from it. It's phenomenal.
He had a, Yeah, he had a huge mouth.
He did. He was in the vault as well, actually. He was...
Who was he in the vault?
He was the president of the vault company. Or
oh, was he? Yeah. Okay, the guy who...
He gets blown up, I guess.
Eyes, I think, yeah. I was so confused by that.
It was awesome. I liked that, though.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't realize it was the same guy. Yeah. That's a really good point. If you had... Then you would have had stakes, right?
As opposed to... you would have wanted people to survive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How did they get Julie Benz to do this?
I was so surprised. That's Dexter's wife, right? From the show Dexter.
She was Dexter's wife, and she was also in Buffy. That's where she got big break, was in Buffy and Angel. And so she's... If any big Buffy the Vampire Slayer fans are out there, they know who Julie Benz is because she's the sire of Angel. She, you know... blah 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 in that mythology. She's not that important in the plot, really.
Right? She's not the lead, I wouldn't say.
No, I'm not entirely sure who the lead is. I don't think she has the most lines.
I was very surprised. Like, I kept thinking maybe it's just somebody that looks a lot like Dexter's wife, but
that's what I thought when I first saw it. I thought somebody who looks a lot like Julie Benz, but can't be Julie Benz. But yeah, no, that was her. But I think that would be a good point. You could have had backstory, you could have had characters, you could have had... there's a suggestion at one point that these people all know each other, and that's important. You could have worked with that a little bit by going outside of the room.
Yeah, because even the ones that were having the affair, that could have been an interesting thread to pull.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a surprise, but the surprise doesn't do anything.
Right.
Right? It's, oh, yeah, they loved each other at one point. But, you know, and it's also weird. Like, why were people who were associated with each other put in that room together? Does that tell us something?
Yeah, you know, the other thing they did is sometimes they repeated the social points they were trying to make.
Yeah, oh yes. Yeah.
Right? Like, it's almost like they ran out. So they're like, all right, well, we got to start focusing on the bad people again. Or wait, let's bring up the kid versus pregnant woman thing again. Like, it was, they kept repeating it. So I wonder, too, in the writing room, if they were like, oh, what if we connect some of these people just to give it more?
More oomph?
Yeah. Because, I mean, that was a fun trick with the married couple, right? That they weren't really married.
I guess. I found it kind of weird.
Well, it was so, near the no payoff or whatever, but
yeah, there's no like they just pretended to be married so that people would be sympathetic to them.
Yeah, right. Then it turns out a bunch of people probably did, but
yeah, I mean, if they were married, would anything change?
The only thing I can imagine is when you don't know who to vote for, you might skip over them every time. So when it's a rando round, they might be a little more immune to it.
All right. Fair enough.
So what do we think, Tom? Does Circle make the list?
I'm going to go with no on this one. So.
I really want to give it a yes, because I feel like it's another important piece of this keep making movies puzzle where you can see what can be done with very little. But I also don't think I'm going to put it on the list. If there's a second list, if there's a B list, if there's a watch these once you're done with the list, maybe this is at the top. But it's not
a B side of the B side?
The B side of the B side.
Is that the C side?
The Circle side. Well, it's official. Circle has not made the list. We've watched some more of Aaron and Mario's movie web series. And we hope they keep making stuff, although there's nothing really on their IMDb. I don't know what's coming later, but I would absolutely be in for another movie by these guys. Audience, what's your favorite movie by Aaron Hahn and Mario Moscone? Let us know on social media at Talking Studios.
You can rate and review this show anywhere fine podcasts are available. For those viewing in YouTube land, if you haven't already, please like this video, subscribe to the Talking Studios channel for all our exciting content, and follow us on social media at Talking Studios. Check out other shows by Talking Studios, including Talking Pictures Trivia, where we explore movies through trivia. Limited Lexicon, where we play through text-based adventure games. Get the Point, where we slowly reveal a movie poster and try to guess which movie poster it is. And Adapt It, where we explore adaptations in various forms. Got a question for us? Call the Talking Studios hotline at 201-467-8679 and leave a message. It may be featured on a future episode. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Keep Making Movies, wherever fine podcasts are found.
Join us next time when we discuss Summer Time Machine Blues from 2005. Stay tuned for our first impression of Summer Time Machine Blues. A little bit of a before and after there, audience. Next week, we'll be discussing Summer Time Machine Blues from 2005. Tom, how was your watch?
My watch was good. This is my first time with this movie. I never heard of it until you suggested it. I think initially it took me a little while to get into it. The style of acting is something we've seen before, the two of us. I mean, not on this show necessarily, but we saw it on Talking Pictures Trivia. Especially Michael Hahn, there is a sort of, we might characterize as a broad acting style, very kind of pronounced, almost clownish acting style that's going on, that always throws me off a little bit. It takes me a moment to kind of get into the movie, almost like getting your taste buds ready for a different flavor. And on top of that, the movie begins with, it's a bit disjointed at the beginning, because it's trying to indicate something is going on in the periphery, which we find out is involved in the time travel plot. And so when you first start watching it, I think I texted you something along the lines of like, what the F is going on? Because you have this really broad acting style. And then you have like this kind of, the plot itself is shaky by intent. And so it does take about, I would say 20, even 30 minutes to settle into what this movie is. And around there, you start to discern the different characters, because up to that point, it's like a bunch of screaming young boys who are for some reason living in a house together that is a science fiction club in which no one reads science fiction.
No, they don't live there. Audience, they don't live there.
They don't live there.
High school.
Oh, it's like their clubhouse. Yeah.
Clubhouse. Yep.
Well, it's a college clubhouse, right? I don't think it's high school.
Oh, you're right. It is university. Yeah. That's true.
But at first, I thought they lived. Like, I wasn't. Where are we? What is the so like?
Yeah.
Why are they taking photographs of them playing baseball?
Right, yeah.
Why are they doing any of this?
Doesn't matter.
It really doesn't matter. And that's what you have to kind of figure out, is like, it's a club of guys who do goofy things. And that's sort of kind of the point of the movie, too, I think, is that even when extraordinary things happen.
All right. That was a very, very intense watch you must have had, Tom.
But I was just for the audience. Take 20 or 30 minutes, get adjusted to it, and actually, it's kind of delightful after that. And so I would recommend it.
Great. Yeah. No, don't dismiss it right away, like Tom's saying. For me, it starts with the poster. I don't know if you've seen the poster, Tom, but the poster looks so inviting. And I was looking for Time Machine movies a while back. I love the title. The titles of Before and After, Summer Time Machine Blues, or I guess that's not a before and after. It's like a before and after. I don't know. Right, it's like, because Summertime Blues, Summertime Machine Blues,
oh.
Right?
I'm not entirely sure how the machine blues.
Well, the time machine, right? As I said, it's almost like a
right.
An out between time and machine. In between.
Yeah. It's very clever.
It's a play on words.
It's a Wheel of Fortune answer. That's
what yes, exactly. So audience, go check it out. It's super fun. I've watched this movie 3 times now, once with my daughter, which was really fun. She really enjoyed it. Like Tom said, sit with it for a little bit. Don't dismiss it and don't get invested in the plot, because there's barely a plot. Summertime Machine Blues is available on Prime Video at the time of this recording.
Wow. Talking Studios,